O'Hare and I gave up on remembering. Went into the living room, talked about other things. We became curious about the real Children's Crusade, so O'Hare looked it up in a book he had, Extraordinary Popular Delusions in the Madness of Crowds by Charles Mackay, LLD. It was first published in London in 1841. Mackay had a low opinion of all crusades. The Children's Crusade struck him as only slightly more sordid than the 10 Crusades for grown-ups. O'Hare read this handsome passage out loud. History, in her solemn page, informs us that the Crusaders were but ignorant and savage men, that their motives were those of bigotry unmitigated, and that their pathway was one of blood and tears. Romance, on the other hand, dilates upon their piety and heroism, and portrays in her most glowing and impassioned hues their virtue and magnanimity, the imperishable honor they acquired for themselves, and the great services they rendered to Christianity. And then O'Hare read this. Now, what was the grand result of all these struggles? Europe expended millions of her treasures and the blood of 2 million of her people, and a handful of quarrelsome knights retained possession of Palestine for about 100 years. Mackay told us that the Children's Crusade started in 1213 when two monks got the idea of raising armies of children in Germany and France and selling them in North Africa as slaves. 30,000 children volunteered, thinking they were going to Palestine. They were no doubt idle and deserted children who generally swarm in great cities nurtured on vice and daring, said Mackay, and ready for anything. Pope Innocent III thought they were going to Palestine too, and he was thrilled. These children are awake while we are asleep, he said. Most of the children were shipped out of Marseille, and about half of them drowned in shipwrecks. The other half got to North Africa, where they were sold. Through a misunderstanding, some children reported for duty at Genoa, where no slave ships were waiting. They were fed and sheltered and questioned kindly by good people there, then given a little money and a lot of advice and sent back home. Hooray for the good people of Genoa, said Mary O'Hare. I slept that night in one of the children's bedrooms. O'Hare had put a book for me on the bedside table. It was Dresden, History, Stage, and Gallery by Mary Endell. It was published in 1908, and its introduction began, It is hoped that this little book will make itself useful. It attempts to give to an English reading public a bird's eye view of how Dresden came to look as it does architecturally, of how it expanded musically through the genius of a few men to its present bloom. And it calls attention to certain permanent landmarks in art that make its gallery the resort of those seeking lasting impressions. I read some history further on. Now, in 1760, Dresden underwent siege by the Prussians. On the 15th of July began the cannonade. The picture gallery took fire. Many of the paintings had been transported to the Königstein, but some were seriously injured by splinters of bombshells, notably Francia's Baptism of Christ. Furthermore, the stately Kreuzkirche Tower, from which the enemy's movements had been watched day and night, stood in flames. It later succumbed. In sturdy contrast with the pitiful fate of the Kreuzkirche stood the Frauenkirche, from the curves of whose stone dome the Prussian bombs rebounded like rain. Friedrich was obliged finally to give up the siege because he learned of the fall of Glatz, the critical point of his new conquests. We must be off to Silesia so that we do not lose everything. The devastation of Dresden was boundless. When Goethe, as a young student, visited the city, he still found sad ruins.
Von der Kuppel der Frauenkirche sah ich diese leidigen Trümmer zwischen die schöne statische Ordnung hineingesat. Darunter mir der Kuste die Kunst des Baumeisters, welche Kirche und Kuppel auf einen so unerwünschten Fall schon eingerichtet und barmenfest erbaut hatte. Der gute Sakristan deute mir alsdann auf Runen nach allen Seiten. und sagte bedenklich, lakonisch,
Das hat der Feind getan.
The two little girls and I crossed the Delaware River where George Washington had crossed it the next morning. We went to the New York World's Fair, saw what the past had been like, according to the Ford Motor Car Company and Walt Disney, saw what the future would be like, according to General Motors. And I asked myself about the present, how wide it was, how deep it was, how much was mine to keep. I taught creative writing in the famous writer's workshop at the University of Iowa for a couple years after that. I got into some perfectly beautiful trouble, got out of it again. I taught in the afternoons. In the mornings, I wrote. I was not to be disturbed. I was working on my famous book about Dresden. And somewhere in there, a nice man named Seymour Lawrence gave me a 3-book contract, and I said, okay, the first of the 3 will be my famous book about Dresden. The friends of Seymour Lawrence call him Sam. And I say to Sam now, Sam, here's the book. It is so short and jumbled and jangled, Sam, because there is nothing intelligent to say about a massacre. Everybody is supposed to be dead, to never say anything or want anything ever again. Everything is supposed to be very quiet after a massacre, and it always is, except for the birds. And what do the birds say? All there is to say about a massacre, things like, Pootiweet. I have told my sons that they are not under any circumstances to take part in massacres, and that the news of massacres of enemies is not to fill them with satisfaction or glee. I have also told them not to work for companies which make massacre machinery, and to express contempt for people who think we need machinery like that. As I've said, I recently went back to Dresden with my friend O'Hare. We had a million laughs in Hamburg and West Berlin and East Berlin and Vienna and Salzburg and Helsinki and in Leningrad, too. It was very good for me because I saw a lot of authentic backgrounds for made-up stories which I will write later on. One of them will be Russian Baroque, and another will be No Kissing, and another will be Dollar Bar, and another will be If the Accident Will, and so on, and so on. There was a Lufthansa plane that was supposed to fly from Philadelphia to Boston to Frankfurt. O'Hare was supposed to get on in Philadelphia, and I was supposed to get on in Boston, and off we'd go. But Boston was socked in, so the plane flew straight to Frankfurt from Philadelphia, and I became a non-person in the Boston fog, and Lufthansa put me in a limousine with some other non-persons and sent us to a motel for a non-night. The time would not pass. Somebody was playing with the clocks, and not only with the electric clocks, but the wind-up kind, too. The second hand on my watch would twitch once, and a year would pass, and then it would twitch again. There was nothing I could do about it. As an earthling, I had to believe whatever clocks said, and calendars. I had 2 books with me, which I'd meant to read on the plane. One was Words for the Wind by Theodore Rethke, and this is what I found in there. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I feel my fate in what I cannot fear. I learn by going where I have to go. My other book was Erika Ostrovsky's Céline and His Vision. Céline was a brave French soldier in the First World War until his skull was cracked. After that, he couldn't sleep, and there were noises in his head. He became a doctor, and he treated poor people in the daytime, and he wrote grotesque novels all night. No art is possible without a dance with death, he wrote. The truth is death, he wrote. I've fought nicely against it as long as I could, danced with it, festooned it, waltzed it around, decorated it with streamers, titillated it. Time obsessed him. Miss Ostrovsky reminded me of the amazing scene in Death on the Installment Plan, where Céline wants to stop the bustling of a street crowd. He screams on paper, "Make them stop. Don't let them move any more at all. There, make them freeze once and for all so that they won't disappear any more." I look through the Gideon Bible in my motel room for tales of great destruction. The sun was risen upon the earth when Lot entered into Zoar, I read. Then the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah, brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities, and all the plain, and all the inhabitants of the cities, and that which grew upon the ground. So it goes. Those were vile people in both those cities, as is well known. The world was better off without them. And Lot's wife, of course, was told not to look back where all those people and their homes had been. But she did look back, and I love her for that, because it was so human. So she was turned to a pillar of salt. So it goes. People aren't supposed to look back. I'm certainly not going to do it anymore. I've finished my war book now. The next one I write is going to be fun. This one is a failure. It had to be, since it was written by a pillar of salt. It begins like this. Listen. Billy Pilgrim has come unstuck in time. It ends like this. Potiweet